The topic of this extemporaneous prayer treatment by the Mary Baker Eddy Institute is Spirit, Reality or Movie. It is very difficult, if not impossible, to tell the difference between a real individual and an imposter. There are advertisements on the internet where one can buy a partial rubber suit for a very low cost that can be worn by someone that looks completely different, but with the rubber suit, the imposter looks real. Kurt Russell, a lifelong actor, was asked in one of these talk shows what is the difference between his character in real life compared to the actors that he plays in movies. And he said, well, my real life is real, but whatever actor I play, that's fantasy land. We are experiencing fantasy land with much of what we see with politicians, unelected individuals that are in control of various government departments, and independent health agencies, CEOs of major corporations, criminals that have been arrested and executed, many of which have doubles or clones, or CGI is being utilized to trick the public, making the public believe that they are still alive and well. There is a concerted effort for many years to drain the swamp. It's almost impossible to tell how much of it has been drained because of these tricks that are being played on the public and promoted by mainstream media that is controlled by the intelligence agencies, who are trying to carry on as if nothing ever happened and no one has ever been arrested or executed. Friedrich L. Rawson, an expert Christian Scientist, stated something to the effect that all life based on a material base is fake, and it's only a movie. You can look at any part of the movie because it has already been created. In fact, he discovered in his healing work how to go back in time and heal a situation that occurred years before, and it wouldn't take much imagination to realize that the entire experience of the individual could be erased from consciousness from the time that they knew or were believed to understand that they had a problem to the present day wherein the problem was healed. On page 261 of the textbook by Mary Baker Eddy entitled Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, she states this under the title of Unreality of Pain. The effect of mortal mind on health and happiness is seen in this. If one turns away from the body with such absorbed interest as to forget it, the body experiences no pain. Under the strong impulse of a desire to perform his part, a noted actor was accustomed night after night to go up on the stage and sustain his appointed task, walking about as actively as the youngest member of the company. This old man was so lame that he hobbled every day to the theater and sat aching in his chair till his cue was spoken, a signal which made him as oblivious of physical infirmity as if he had inhaled chloroform, though he was in the full possession of his so-called senses. Is that a wake-up call for all of us? What would happen to any ailment one would have if they looked upon it as going onto a stage and being totally different in the way they appeared, including all thought, speech, and action, compared to the way they were prior to going on the stage. There are three quotes at the beginning of the Christian Science textbook. One, ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Those are the words of Jesus, quoted by John. Quote number two, there is nothing, either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. Number three, oh, thou hast heard my prayer, and I am blessed. This is thy high behest, thou here and everywhere. Mary Baker Eddy. If one connects the dots between those three quotes and this text that was just recited from page 261, it's easy to see the connection with the title. Is it reality or a movie? Suppose we thought of the time on the stage was reality, and the pain and suffering that the individual experienced before he went on the stage and when he got off the stage was the movie, or the play in this case. Suppose everyone conducted their life, their thoughts, speech, and action in the same manner. Suppose if one observed an accident, or maybe even involved in the accident. The accident could be giving an appearance of injury or even loss of life. Maybe an effect on one's consciousness that they could no longer comprehend properly everything that was going on. Now suppose that everyone that observed the accident had the ability to look upon it as a movie and not reality. What effect do you think that would have on the circumstance? When Jesus saw someone that had a problem, what did he do? Didn't he look upon the problem as unreal, as a movie, as a suggestion only, even when he was faced with the most severe circumstances? Let's say that is death of Lazarus or Tabitha, the young girl. Did he accept what the physical senses were screaming, that these people were dead? Or did he create his own atmosphere of truth and accept what the Bible says about man being created in the image and likeness of God, and everything is good? Mary Baker Eddy defines good on page 587 in the glossary as being God, spirit, omnipotence, omniscience, omnipresence, and omniaction. An accident would be considered an action. Suppose we looked upon that action as being fake, as being a trick. If anyone has ever visited a movie studio and taken a tour wherein they show how movies are made, it reveals some very interesting things. And these same tactics are utilized by so-called intelligence agencies in an effort to trick the perception of the public. It's one of many tactics of evil. Do we want to be led by tricks, deception, decoys, in order to hide the truth? Suppose we limited our conversation to comparing the truth about the real man as defined in Genesis chapter 1 whereby God said that man was made in his image and likeness, and that everything that he made was very good. And what about if we dismissed what the insurance companies try to make people believe, that when there's a catastrophe, that it's an act of God? Yet there's nothing in the Bible that is real about God that ascribes to God the cause of anything that is unlike himself, whereas he is defined in the Bible and by Mary Baker Eddy as being incorporeal, divine, supreme, infinite mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, love. That's from page 465. And in the glossary, page 587, he is defined as God is the great I am, all-knowing, all-seeing, all-acting, all-wise, all-loving, and eternal. Principle, mind, soul, spirit, life, truth, love, all-substance, intelligence. It says all loving. If God were loving, would he be creating catastrophes where people were killed or injured? Think of a war. It's been proven that every war has been man-made, and there was some evil purpose that brought it about, and there was deception used on the population to agree to war in most cases, and they were led to believe that that was the only option there was. And yet principle is defined as being balance and harmony, structure and system. It sounds to me like war is the opposite. It is chaos, not harmony. It is things out of balance instead of in balance. And it is typically initiated due to greed of someone or some group or some government or some country that are operated by corrupt motives that want to get something for nothing. Something that other people have the ownership of or created out of their own industrial capacity. And there's an element of jealousy. The Bible says that's the reason Judas betrayed Jesus for, what was it, 12 pieces of silver? I don't know how long it was expected for 12 pieces of silver to last, but that certainly doesn't qualify as being the golden rule. When Jesus was asked, what is the most important commandment? He said, love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind. And the second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. He gave them as one unified commandment. He says, and the second is like unto it. The Bible clearly states that one cannot love God, which is invisible, unless he loves the symbols of God, which are visible. Loving your neighbor as yourself is something you can do that is visible. You can care about them. You can give to them. You can help them. You can think good about them. When the disciples asked Jesus, how many times should we forgive someone? 7 times? And he said, 70 times 7. Mary Baker Eddy wrote an article, Love Your Enemies. And she says, who is thine enemy except someone that we have fabricated in our own thought that is an enemy? That individual may not even think of us as an enemy, but we're harboring hate fear, and whatever other terms that we want to use to justify or rationalize to consider them an enemy. What happens when someone loves, truly loves in an impersonal way, someone that is considered an enemy? It could be a country. How do you think the people would act within the country? Right now, there are a lot of warring factors, and some countries are going into these other countries and nurturing an agreement for trade, not even thinking about maybe evil acts that the so-called politicians have done, but thinking of a way that they can have an agreement for harmonious transactions. That could even be a positive influence on the people deciding to forget all about following a path of evil, because they're getting something that they didn't expect. And the country that is going in there to nurture trading with them is giving something of mutual benefit. The organization called BRICS, B-R-I-C-S, which originally started with just five countries, the initials of the BRICS represent, their purpose in originally starting was to have a trade agreement so that all of them could be trading and be free of other countries that were trying to control them. They wanted to get along. They wanted to have a cooperation that would be mutually beneficial for everyone concerned. What happens if we conducted our life in that same manner and did only things that would be mutually beneficial to everyone concerned? A true negotiator of a business transaction is not going to be one that is deceptive to try to trick people into agreeing to something, whether it's by a handshake or it's a complex written document. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we didn't even need documents, but everyone would operate with integrity? And if there was some misunderstanding that came up later, that they would sit down as mature, unselfish individuals with a pure motive and fix the problem to the benefit of everyone concerned? Try giving to someone that you have a disagreement with. Try walking down the street and smiling at someone that is wearing a frown. We have lots of reasons to smile. Just look at what Mary Baker Eddy gave the world. She was able to define what God is. That had been a puzzle forever. No one had clearly been able to define God. There were bits and pieces scattered throughout the Bible, but to actually connect all the dots had not been done. There are physicists that studied the world and tried to figure out what made it tick. They spent their whole life doing it, some of them, and they never came up with the root notions of man or the universe. They look upon the heavens in awe, A-W-E, wondering, how did this come about? This has so many variables. Why is it that all of these things that are very small lights to us, being a large distance away, far distance away, how is it that they're not always crashing into each other? Humans, so-called, on planet Earth, are crashing into each other, and we're supposed to have five senses that could prevent them, prevent all of these catastrophes. Seeing, hearing, feeling, tasting, and smelling. Are we using them in a spiritual way? Let alone, are we even using them in a so-called material way? Mary Baker Eddy said Jesus was able to be so divine because he was an expert at overcoming the human aspects. The magnitude of his humanity is what enabled him to experience divinity. We have to deal successfully with the visible before we can even approach the invisible. We need to be fed up with our life as it is and know that there is something better. We don't know what it is, but we want to search for it. We want to benefit from it. And I don't think there's anyone that would not say that they would love to live in an entity that is as people dream of heaven to be. We have heaven right here if we would only recognize it and live it. Wentworth Winslow, another expert Christian Scientist, said, imagine that you are in a room and there's a telephone and there's a radio, or it could be the internet, it could be anything. This was said, I don't know, 75 or 100 years ago. He said, imagine the radio was tuned into station KOG, Kingdom of God, and all it was doing was announcing all of the qualities of God and how good God is, and that man was his image and likeness and made perfectly and experiencing harmony. Everybody was getting along to the benefit of everyone. And the telephone was just ringing its head off, trying to tempt us to pick it up and let it say whatever it wanted to say in our ear. And we listened to it and took it in as part of our consciousness. And we're devoting time to think about it, talk about it, and do the suggestions that it was making. Jesus said that if we think about something, it's the same as doing it. So even without the acts, if we're thinking about it, and we're probably going to be talking about it if we think about it, we don't even have to do it. But whatever it was, if it wasn't good, we're as criminal as if we actually did it. In a court of law, if it is a legitimate court, which are far and few between, to material sense, they look for the motive of the one that has been accused of doing something wrong. And if they can't find a motive, they're not supposed to convict them. In other words, come to the conclusion that they're guilty. What kind of a conclusion are we coming to about ourselves and others? Are we jumping the gun? Are we ignoring the fact that there may be no motive? And suppose we thought of the only mind, M-I-N-D, that was directing anyone was the mind of God, which, of course, Jesus was the greatest example on earth, at least the first one. There have been other ones. These ones that I've mentioned, and of course Mary Baker Eddy is another one, of course, they had to love everyone. Jesus had everyone hated him. Even when he said Lazarus and Tabitha were sleeping, they laughed at him. They didn't take or follow what Albert Einstein said. And he said, curiosity has its own reason for existing. Never stop questioning. Did they even stop to question? Gosh, what is this guy talking about? This guy named Jesus. Does he know something we don't know? Let's ask him. Maybe he's right. Dale Carnegie wrote a book, several books, and he was a trainer of individuals that wanted to be successful. By the way, he made some very complimentary statements about Mary Baker Eddy. And he wrote these books back during the Depression. 100 years ago, approximately. And he said, you better not express a strong opinion, because tomorrow you may be enlightened and have the opposite opinion. So don't ever have a strong argument against someone, because if you have a strong opinion about something, you are blocking your thought and are never going to be adopting what Einstein says we should do, and that says never stop questioning. Maybe we're wrong. I mean, if it's a human opinion, there's a very good chance we're going to be wrong. Only if it is a conclusion after considering spiritual facts could we come to any kind of a conclusion that could be valid. Because it's not based on humanity or a brain. It's based on spirit, which is God. I recited 3 definitions, 2 about God and 1 about good. And man is similar as God's reflection. Man is defined as the compound idea of infinite spirit, the spiritual image and likeness of God, the full representation of mind. Mind is intelligence, wisdom, knowing. Can we be reflecting intelligence, wisdom, and knowing and let the brain, so-called, make decisions for us? I mean, we're in another dimension if we're letting the intelligence of divine mind be doing all the thinking. I mean, one of those definitions says that God is the great I am, all-knowing. If God is all-knowing, what in the world are we trying to do? Are we trying to tell God something we think God doesn't know? The Bible clearly states that God is all. God is all. Mary Baker Eddy defines God to include the term omni, which is one, only, and all. The only one. No competition, no opposition. It's one, only, and all. Are we going to argue with that? We're going to lose every single time. Are we intelligent enough that we're going to advise God about a problem we have? We're going to advise the all-knowing on the website, in the menu, by the website, the name is MBE, short for Mary Baker Eddy, MBE Institute, so that people don't have to type in the complete spelling. MBEinstitute.org. Back when the internet first started, ORG instead of .com was used for organizations that were nonprofit. So that's how the .org came about. We also own the domain .com. So if you typed in .com, you would see the identical website. But think about that. What do we want in our consciousness? The truth, as the very first quote at the beginning of the textbook says, ye shall know the truth. What do we know? What do we want to know the truth about? Do we want to know the truth about whether we're looking at a movie or we're looking about, you know, at reality? The only thing that is reality is God, which includes God's manifestation, which includes you and me. The invisible includes symbols that are visible. When we see a beautiful rose that has a wonderful fragrance, or a beautiful scenery, landscape, beautiful trees, a beautiful individual. What is a beautiful individual? Remember, they may be wearing a rubber mask. Underneath, they may be not very attractive. There was this TV movie or TV series. I don't remember offhand what the name of it was. It was a long time ago. And they would invite a couple, maybe several during the entire TV show, a man and a woman that were married, and they would introduce them to the audience, And then they would have them go into separate rooms that were soundproof. And they would tell the audience they're going to invite one of them out and ask them about their mate, their spouse. And the audience, of course, already had some kind of an opinion about them by just seeing them. And in this case, the woman was a little bit overweight. And in terms of a material sense, she wasn't really pretty. But they had her stay in a room and they asked the husband to come out and ask him what he thought of his wife. He said, "Oh, I love her. She's the most beautiful woman in the world." And the moderator asked him why he was saying that. He says, "Well, I have a very demanding job. I leave early in the morning. I work hard all day long. I come home and I'm tired. And before I leave work, before I even get out of bed, she's up. She's preparing breakfast, preparing lunches for me, and we have two kids. And she gets us off to wherever we're going. I go to work and they go to school. And everybody is prepared for the day. And then, of course, after we leave, then she cleans up the mess and takes care of the home and does whatever, you know, a homemaker would be doing. And when I come home, it's the same thing. She asks me how I did. She takes care of every need. The clothes are always clean and pressed, ironed. The house is clean and orderly. Everything is organized. If the kids have something they need to do after school, she takes care of it. And I have a real peaceful life when I get home. If the kids need help on their schoolwork, she's there. I love her. She's beautiful. How could anyone ask for someone better than this?" You see, the individuals that were in the audience, they looked upon appearance. With today's technology, that woman may have been beautiful and totally outfitted to not look so beautiful, like they do in movies all the time, or vice versa. They take someone that's not so attractive and they make them look attractive. He looked at the qualities of his wife, not the appearance. The qualities overshadowed anything about the appearance. That was what was attracting him to make the comments that he made. He was looking at the reality of who she really was as an image and likeness of God's qualities, not the movie that says that we are mortals that are born sinners, as it states in Genesis chapter 2, right after it says there went up a mist. Who can see clearly in a mist? Have you ever been in a thick fog where you couldn't see anything? Well, that's what happened in Genesis chapter 2. And then it talks about Adam and Eve. And we're supposed to be an offspring of Adam and Eve. We've been ingrained through universal belief that everyone is born a sinner. And we might try to become better than that, but we start off with a terrible heritage. Is that what we're going to accept as being reality about us? Or are we going to be like Jesus and look underneath the surface for the real instead of looking at the surface, which is a trick, a decoy, a deception, an illusion? Most people have probably seen the work of a hypnotist or a magician. They have them on television, and it's easy to check them out. The illusionist, or the individual that's trying to trick the audience, creates a deception, a decoy, to get their attention, so that he can do things that they're not paying attention to. And then when they see the result, not seeing even how it took place, then they're totally tricked. They believe what is real is unreal and what is unreal is real. A magic trick is exactly what everything in the world is that is discord. that is sickness, that is chaos. Which do we want to believe? The reality, as it's stated in the Bible and repeated by Mary Baker Eddy, about the real man and the real God and the real Jesus? Or do we want to accept the lie that a man, Jesus, is God, and that Jesus is omnipresent? In other words, he's in America, he's in South America, he's in Canada, he's in Europe, Asia, Africa, all at the same time. And yet he's a man. Do we want to hate our neighbor because we think they did something that we don't approve of? Or are we going to listen to what Jesus said about forgiving? Not 7 times, but 70 times 7. 490. Are we going to forgive 490 times before we say, okay, you're not worth forgiving anymore? Why would we ever want to forgive anybody? Don't we have to condemn them first? What are we going to forgive them of if we haven't condemned them? Dr. Fluno was one of Mary Baker Eddy's earliest lecturers, and one of his topics that he specialized in was criticism. This was back like 1870, 1880, 1890. It was not easy to travel, but he traveled. These early lecturers, they went through very strong inconveniences to get where they needed to go to lecture about Christian Science. He said, don't even touch criticism with a 10-foot pole. I'm putting in some colloquials. He said, criticism leads to all evil. All evil. He didn't say, well, it's a bad habit. He said it leads to all evil. If we want to be practicing evil, all we have to do is practice criticism. What did Mary Baker Eddy do? Mary Baker Eddy prayed every hour. And I imagine she was probably active 18 hours a day. So let's say she had 18 prayers. For what purpose? For one purpose and one purpose only. To make sure that she had no ill thoughts about anyone regarding anything. In other words, she was looking only for good in everything about the world and everyone about the world. I mean, in everyone in the world. That's what she was focusing on. And she reminded herself approximately 18 times a day. I don't know how long she devoted to it. She doesn't say. But she does make a public statement because she was accused of being prayerless. And so she made statements that said that she prayed every hour and 3 times a day for all humanity. I think those were in 2 different situations. One, the one about praying 3 times a day for all humanity was in response to being accused of being prayerless. And she stated elsewhere that she prayed hourly. And those are not even dedicated for a particular topic. She obviously had other prayer work that she did, as did everyone that was living in her home with her, that were there for the purpose of learning the advanced course in Christian Science, System of Divine Metaphysics. Here is what Mary Baker Eddy said about divine metaphysics. Divine metaphysics is now reduced to a system, to a form comprehensible by and adapted to the thought of the age in which we live. This system enables the learner to demonstrate the divine principle upon which Jesus' healing was based and the sacred rules for its present application to the cure of disease. That's from page 146 from the textbook. Contemplate that. You could probably talk to 1 million Christian Scientists who have probably read that many times and they gloss over it and have no idea what important information she is conveying to the reader. They may not be hearing it, but it's being said. Let me read what she says on page 330. When the 32 planks of the platform is understood and the letter and the spirit bear witness, the infallibility of divine metaphysics will be demonstrated. And then from page 330 to 340, 11 pages, she presents those 32 topics. And you talk about a book that is properly structured. Wow. She gives us the introductory quotes to the whole book, as was recited, three of them. There are introductory quotes to the chapters, and there are topics throughout the entire book. And if you've done any studying about how to read a book properly, these are the things you look for, to look for the key ideas. And wow, she gives us a roadmap, a complete blueprint. All we have to do is wake up. How many times does one look at the paragraph title? Or it's really a topic, because sometimes there's, you know, one paragraph, maybe multiple paragraphs. So let's call it a topic title. Some people call it marginal headings, because some printings show the topic in the margin. Do we pay any attention to those? Do we read the introduction to the chapter before we read anything in the chapter? Do we read and contemplate the three introductory quotes to the textbook before we open the textbook to read anything in the textbook? She has the structure so easy, and these are her words. This isn't something that the printer dreamed up and put in there by himself. These are very important points that we must understand their value and follow them, or we're going to miss a lot about what Christian Science is all about. Are we even curious about them? Most people aren't. If you take 1 million people, the majority is in the middle, a C student in school. Then you got a few that are failures and a few that are A-plus students. You got a few more, you got more that are Bs, and you got more Ds than you have that are failures. But very few people pay attention to what they're reading. How about the manual? Does anyone really study the manual? She said she hoped that she wouldn't have to provide a manual, but she could see that the church was going so far astray that they had to have a manual. Jesus didn't even have a church. Everything he accomplished was without a single church structure. In fact, Mary Baker Eddy gave us the definition of church. Here it is. The structure of truth and love. Whatever rests upon and proceeds from divine principle. The church is that institution which affords proof of its utility and is found elevating the race, rousing the dormant understanding from material beliefs to the apprehension of spiritual ideas and the demonstration of divine science, thereby casting out devils or error and healing the sick. Do we pay attention to what she's saying? Do we think that going inside a building once a week, or if we're really good, we go on Wednesday twice a week and spend 1 hour, 2 hours a week, and there's 12 hours just from when we get up until we are going into the evening, 24 hours a day. And that's not even, you know, what is it? 2 hours out of 24 times 7. Very small decimal. very small decimal. It says in the Bible we should pray without ceasing. The only way that I can think that that could be done is if we are living our prayer. The third quote at the beginning of the textbook says, "Oh, thou hast heard my prayer, and I am blessed. This is thy high behest, thou here and everywhere. Thou hast heard my prayer." In other words, are we living our life in alignment with the laws of God? She obviously was. Jesus obviously was. These other people that were expert Christian Scientists obviously were. Mr. Winslow received a telegram. This was before telephones were apparently available, at least internationally. He received a telegram that said, "Six treatments, please." He didn't even know where it came from, other than the country. It was South America. He was living in New York. He's thinking to himself. He explains this in one of his four books. He's thinking to himself, where do I begin? Where do I begin? I cannot ask the individual any questions. I don't even know how to get a telegram to him. The thought occurred to him that the best way he could possibly help the individual was to live a prayer of perfection. So he tried his very best at his highest level of understanding to live as Genesis 1 states, in the image and likeness of God. Everything that he did, he tried to make sure he was living in accordance with Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. After the six treatments, I don't know whether he mentions it was 6 days or what, but he got another telegram and it says, "Six more treatments, please." He didn't know anything else to do except continue what he was doing. Our thought reaches out to every receptive thought. If we're living a life of misery, that is the thought we're putting into the atmosphere of universal thought. If we are living a life where we are doing our level best to be an image and likeness of God, that goes out into the atmosphere of thought. And this individual obviously was having a receptive thought. So he continued on for six more treatments. After that, he got a communication from the individual, and he identified, where he was. And he said, "I want you to know that this was a case of insanity. And it was for a friend of mine, and the first six treatments healed him. But no one around him believed he was healed. So I asked for the six additional treatments, and then they were healed of the belief that he had not been healed." If you study Christian Science seriously, you'll see that it is stated a number of times that we must include anyone that is influencing the thought of the individual to make sure that they get the benefit of the work that's being done. So that's the story. The healing was effective on those around him, so they would recognize the healing. Jesus was laughed at all the time. I mentioned about Lazarus and Tabitha, the young girl, and who came to the crucifixion of Jesus to support him, or even who came to the trial. No one came to the trial. I don't believe there's a record of anyone coming to the trial that supported Jesus. He was ridiculed by everyone. And a half a dozen attended the crucifixion. His mother, Mary Magdalene, John, the disciple, and there's no evidence John ever passed on. He disappeared. No evidence of his body. So he's deemed to be ascended. And Jesus came back after his ascension to dictate the book of Revelation. That's all explained by Dr. Robert C. Putnam, a very fine Bible scholar, probably second only to Mary Baker Eddy, although there's other fine ones, people I mentioned, Joel Goldsmith, Frederick L. Rawson, and Wentworth Winslow all had 15-minute appointments. When the 15 minutes was over, the individual was healed. There's a record that Wentworth Winslow had been in the practice for 35 years, and Frederick L. Rawson doesn't say how many years, and Joe Goldsmith, 16 years, in one office in Boston, Massachusetts. They were getting all the business because they were effective. Joe Goldsmith walked into a nursing home for Christian Scientists. He had been called there by one of the patients. And when he walked in, the receptionist said, "You can't go in there. Everyone has a contagious disease." And I guess there were several hundred in the building. He went over and sat down a few minutes in the lobby. And then the nurses started coming out, saying, "What happened?" Everybody was healed at the same time. He had told the receptionist, he says, "You only have one problem here." You know, however many hundreds of people were there, you don't have that many problems, you only have one. These people had studied so sincerely, and they lived their life of their prayer, that they were getting these kind of results. What was Jesus most known for? Out of the seven synonymous terms of principle, spirit, soul, life, truth, and love, and Mary Baker Eddy, L-O-V-E, love. They loved even though they were constantly attacked by everyone around them. Mary Baker Eddy begins chapter 12, which is Christian Science practice, which is how you're supposed to be conducting yourself if you're in the practice of providing services to other people for prayer. She begins with the story of Mary Magdalene. That's the epitome of forgiveness and love. And she wrote that article, "Love Your Neighbor, Love Your Enemy," excuse me. "Love Your Enemy." We have a presentation on our website that says heal everything. And the very first step is we have to learn to love impersonally everyone. And what is love? Love is giving. The Bible says we should tithe. Most people think of that as being money. Money is a small part, even though it's important. As long as people need to have food, shelter, and clothing, money is the denomination that is utilized to pay for them. But that's the visible symbol. The real supply comes from the invisible concept that God is everything. God is all source. And we are all a part of God's manifestation. How much do we give in money? Do we give 10% of our income, 10% of our assets? How about our time? There's 1,440 minutes a day. How much of it do we use for giving, for studying about God, for praying for the world? Do we pray 18 times, in fact, 21 times a day, like Mary Baker Eddy did, as a minimum? Do we remind ourselves every hour to pray, to get our thoughts straight, to make sure we're not thinking ill thoughts about anyone or anything? Anytime, under any circumstance, if we see a stray dog on the street, do we make a conscious effort to find some food real fast and water? I know someone that carries around a container of food in a plastic bag and a portable thing to put it on, paper plate to put it on, and water, container of water. Have you ever seen anyone that looked like they were in need? Have you ever seen anyone in a wheelchair? Have you ever seen an accident occur or be there after it and there's still chaos around? Do you know of anyone that needs food, shelter, or clothing? Have you ever thought about giving away your most favorite clothes, your tastiest food, cooking for someone? Or showing them how to cook if they didn't know how to cook? Clean their house? Jesus washed the feet of his disciples. I mean, back in those days, there was no paved roads. I don't know, maybe they had some cobblestone, but mostly people were walking on dirt roads. And it was a courtesy to wash their feet if they were visiting you. Nobody washed Jesus' feet when he was in the house of Simon, where Mary Magdalene visited. She did it. Do we have any special talents we can teach someone else? Do we know about piano? Can we give piano lessons? That's a kind of a generic instrument. And in today's technology, these keyboards are inexpensive. You don't have to buy an expensive piano. You can do it on a keyboard. At least get started. If you actually want to be cultivating a life of giving, you will be open to ideas, and you will find, if you are interested in cultivating a life of giving, many avenues will open to you that you can go down that path. And instead of walking on the other side of the road, like the story in the Bible about the Good Samaritan, only one person walked by and actually took care of the man and took him to a hotel and paid for his needs and said he would come back and take care of any additional expenses. Everyone else walked on the other side of the road because they didn't want to get involved. Edmund Burke is credited back around 1770 with a quote about evil. He said, if you observe evil, the most common thing is for good men to walk away and do nothing. Are you one that wants to do nothing when there's a need? He says that's the way evil triumphs. When good men do nothing, there's a need and they do nothing. We cannot have a life that is productive and really do something good for humanity if we're not going to live a life of giving. That is number one on the list. Number one, a life of giving is absolutely number one. Jesus did it. Mary Baker Eddy did it. Frederick L. Rawson did it. Wentworth Winsler did it. Joel Goldsmith did it. Frederick L. Rawson said, our reason for being on planet Earth is to make other people happy. He's the one that figured out how to overcome the belief of time and go back in time to bring forth the healing. Wentworth Winslow raised a boy from the dead. Bicknell Young raised himself from the dead. He had been declared dead from drowning. Everything's on the website, mbeinstitute.org. We have a very comprehensive menu. We have things in the footer, things in the header, and you can get to where you want very quickly. We have a contact page that you make contact with us if you have any questions. It explains how to do that by clicking the contact page. I'm going to close by reciting to you one of seven special prayers that Mary Baker Eddy gave to her class, her most advanced class, the last class that she taught in her metaphysical college in 1898, 127 years ago. She titled them, she did seven of them, one for each of the seven synonymous terms, and she titled them Diapason of Heaven. Everything that been discussed here is on our website. This is totally extemporaneous, so you may find some mistakes because we don't edit any of these. When they are presented, they are then posted on the website. We have hundreds of them on the website about any topic you can imagine. And of course, chapter 18 of the textbook has 486 healings, all verified from 85 people. So they each had just under six healings apiece. And these were all verified and approved by Mary Baker Eddy to be published out of thousands that she chose from. We have an opportunity to live in a dimension that is above and beyond what very few people are aware that even exists. And she has it all covered in the textbook, plus she wrote 16 other books, and there's other unpublished writings that have been published by her. Everything's on the website. I shall now recite the Diapason of Heaven with a focus on spirit. Diapason of Heaven, spirit. We must declare often that spirit is not an invisible personality inhabiting a material body. Spirit has no other meaning than God and substance. We must declare there is only one spirit, and that is God. Spirit is my God, and my God is spirit. Individual, incorporeal, immaterial. Spirit is enthroned in my consciousness. Matter and personal sense are not enthroned. We must declare these statements for ourselves in our work. Amen. This is Sunday, October 28 at 15:16. Thank you for listening to this extemporaneous prayer treatment on the topic of spirit. Is it reality or a movie that we see? The end.